Guys, let me show you something. One of the learning highlights of the summer, the various Yume'iyun that take place over the course of the summer. Tonight is our first Le'el Yun, where we have Rabbi Berg and Rabbi Bronfeld to address us on the topic of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash that we're obviously mourning for over the course of these 3 weeks. Please give your attention to Rabbi Berg and Rabbi Bronfeld at 9:45. At 9:45, Rav Tversky will be speaking to everybody in the Beis Medrash. Please make your way, not to your dorms, but rather to the Beis Medrash at 9:45. Please give your undivided attention to Rav Berg and Rav Bronfeld.
Okay, Rabosai. We have a very special privilege to spend the evening with Rabbi Bronfeld, greatest of all time in NCSY Kol history. Game-winning shot in OT today. Give it up for Rabbi Bronfeld.
Pfeiffer
what?
I tripped. It wasn't really.
Pfeiffer did not get tripped. Oh. Rumors of the penalty that wasn't called are unfounded. NCSY Colo Sports. Sorry, buddy. I've had the privilege of knowing Rabbi Bronfeld for a long time. Sitting to his right is one of the great privileges every summer. Once or twice a summer to get to hang out with you guys. To answer any question that you guys have. Obviously, nobody's saying that these are the definitive answers. These are the only answers. As always, we encourage you guys to think and ask questions. We're not trying to brainwash you guys. We authentically want to hear from you, and you're smart enough to think for yourself. So this is just an opportunity to hash out some issues. There's a couple of questions that they have over here that we'll answer first, because there's a specific 3 weeks topic here tonight. But after we finish with this, we really want to open it up to questions from you guys and any questions that you guys have. So while we're answering these questions, it's a good opportunity to think about questions that you care about in order to answer these questions, hopefully meaningful questions for the rest of your life. And we thank you for not going through Rabbi Tarragon and Rabbi Blachman, coming to the cooler Rebbeim and NCSY Kol. L'chaim, good for you. Okay, so the first question, I'll let Rabbi Bronfeld answer first. The first question is, why is the Beis HaMikdash such a loss? We have shuls and places where we could congregate. I assume they mean to daven. What exactly was so important about the Beis HaMikdash? Rabbi Bronfeld.
Thank you, Rabbi Berg, for that beautiful introduction. You know, it's a real pleasure to also, you know, have you on my right over here. And Shkoyach, no, pleasure to be here. Again, like Berg said, you know, we want follow-up. It's just the beginning. Whether the follow-up is now or the follow-up is the rest of the summer, we're here for you guys. And again, we'll talk about Eretz Yisrael, the Chorin Beis HaMikdash, but open anything you really want to ask, agree that, you know, tonight's the night to do it, okay? So this stuff is endless. You know, it's we're holding the 3 weeks. If you haven't figured it out, you know, there's a gradual build-up. The 3 weeks, then we're starting on Sunday night, 9 days. Then you have Shavua Shalchalbo, the week of Tisha B'Av. Then you have Erev Tisha B'Av, and Tisha B'Av itself. Now, obviously, the whole build-up of all this is the mourning of the Beis HaMikdash. The suffering, the mourning and the sadness that we're supposed to experience for the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. So when you ask, why is the Beis HaMikdash such a loss? I mean, the truth is it is a great, meaning it's, in a way, the best question. It's also the worst question also. Meaning it's the best question because this is our vote that we have to feel the loss. If you don't feel the loss, you're missing the point. That's the whole build-up. That's the whole build-up of all this. But really why it's the worst question, I forget where I heard this mashal, is if, God forbid, you know, someone's sitting Shiva. I remember my father, when my father was sitting Shiva for his mother, for my grandmother, I remember that before the burial, you're considered an Onain. An Onain is, you know, after the burial, that's when you're actually sitting Shiva, and you're an Avel. But those first few hours, or my grandmother was buried in Eretz Yisrael, so those first day or so, you're an Onain. And it's a whole question, what mitzvot is doing them or not doing them. But my father refused to eat. He didn't want to eat. And my mother had to say, go and eat. You have to eat. She made him some food. And she didn't force feed him, but she was close to it. And the reason was, is because when you're really in mourning, you know, You don't want to do these things. You don't want to eat. You don't want to shower. You know, get those halachos, you know, a different time. You don't want to do the physical. And the question is why? And if Chazal set it up that we can't do those things, obviously they're teaching us that it's like that. It's like Chas V'Shalom and your mother or father passed away. So that, again, it's not easy to get to that level. Okay, that's why it's a great question how to get to that level. But really, it's muster to us that, meaning, again, if God forbid you're sitting Shiva, you're not going to call up your rabbi, you won't call up Rabbi Berger or myself and say, Rabbi, like, what should I feel? My blank relative, you know, passed away. You know, how should I feel? You know how I'm going to feel. So that's what we're supposed to feel. We're supposed to feel that a close relative, Hashem's not physical, but we're supposed to feel that is a real loss. I'll give you one more mashal. I heard this from a shir from our Pesach Kron. He said, imagine a beautiful wedding. Okay, I got married in Marina Del Rey. Where'd you get married?
Not Marina Del Rey.
Sorry, okay, fine. Okay.
I didn't marry no rich girl.
So that's not
I ain't no gold digger.
All right, so...
You ain't messing with no broke NCSY Kolo Rebbe.
You have to hang out more often. I'll teach. Okay, all right. The kids there, imagine a beautiful wedding hall. Okay, great. You know, ice sculptures. We didn't have that, you know. But ice sculptures, you know, a 20-piece band. The food, delicious, the shmorg, everything. Imagine the perfect wedding. You have the chasson, okay, a hunk. And you have everything. And everything is perfect. And you come in there, you're eating, you're loving, everything's perfect. But there's one problem. The problem is the kala didn't show up. There's no, so everything else could be perfect. It could be gorgeous. It could be perfect. The music, the clothes, everyone, the gifts. But if there's no kala there, what's the point? In a way, that's the world now. Baruch Hashem, things are going great. Overall, things are great. But without the base of Mikdash, there's no kala. And without a kala, you have no wedding.
How many people here really mourn the loss of the base of Mikdash? Raise your hand if you do. If you really feel like you're in mourning. Right, we got one. And 1 second. We got one and he's lying. You want to know the loss of the Beis HaMikdash? That's the loss of the Beis HaMikdash. Nobody feels it. Nobody feels it. That's the loss. The loss is not that you lost the Beis HaMikdash. The loss is that we have no idea what we lost. I personally feel little to nothing. Little to nothing. How could I? I never saw it. I've learned a tremendous amount about it. And I know that there are righteous people out there that really feel it. I'm not that way. I just don't. I wish I did, but I don't. I think I'm in the same boat, probably as many of you and probably as most of the people that you know. And it's good when you can go to like a tzaddik on Tisha B'Av, like I used to go to Moshe Weinberger, and he really feels it. And that's awesome. It's awesome that you could see somebody that's like a relic of generations past that actually felt this. But today, we are spoiled, and we don't feel it. That's the loss. All right, Rabbi Bronfeld, next question. You read this one.
Why is there a need for a Jewish homeland? What is gained religiously from being there? Is the quality of religious life in Israel greater than in Chutz Laretz? And in what way?
Asking the question why there's a need for a Jewish homeland is like asking the question why is there a need for your heart? There is no need for a Jewish homeland. Having a Jewish homeland is as natural to a Jew as being a Jew. A Jew who doesn't have a Jewish homeland is fundamentally missing something about his Judaism. So it's another foolish question. Again, it's a great question, but it's a foolish question. It's not a need. And is religious life greater here? Look around. If you haven't figured that out by now, again, there's something missing. I'll tell you what my Rebbe told me, Rav Parnas. He told me that Rav Soloveitchik used to say the following. The Gemara says, Avira de Eretz Yisrael machkim. The land of Eretz Yisrael makes you smarter. So a couple of Talmidim came to Rav Soloveitchik and they said, Rebbe, we're not going to be in Shir next Zman. He said, why? They said, we're going to Eretz Yisrael. He said, why would you go to Eretz Yisrael? So they said, what do you mean? The Gemara says, Avira de Eretz Yisrael machkim. So Rav Soloveitchik said, no, you're misunderstanding the Gemara. The Gemara means that Israel is more intense. If you're wise, it intensifies your wisdom. And if you're a fool, it intensifies your stupidity. And then he looked at these three guys and he told them, you guys should stay in America. Yes, Eretz Yisrael is more intense. Yes, there's a greater focus here. People are more real. Life is slower. It doesn't have all the accoutrements that come with living in America. We don't have fancy houses. We live nicely. We're not living impoverished. But we're not living with great wealth. I was in America a couple of months ago and I was walking in Teaneck, Ir HaKodesh. And in Teaneck, I was on a regular block. And I commented to some of the Talmidim that were with me. I said, man, this block is unbelievable. Look at the front lawns that they have and the big backyards. And it was a relatively regular block without giant houses. And they were laughing that I thought that was beautiful. But on my block, I live in what's called a quad, meaning it's a house that probably is the size of many of the houses that you guys live in, but it's divided into four. We're not focused on the same things. Here we're focused on the essence. Now, there are legitimate halachic reasons not to live in Eretz Yisrael. Taiva is not one of them. Just because you don't want to is not a legitimate reason not to live in Israel. The reality is that American Jewry should be embarrassed. Should be embarrassed. Under 10% of American Jewry makes Aliyah. And we're not talking about American Jewry. We're not talking about people that never came to Israel. I'm talking about guys that came on NCSY Kollel, that went on Sulam or whatever other program, and then they spent their year in Israel. Good kids that marched in the Israeli Day Parade. Chevra, the number of you guys that will actually make Aliyah is pitiful and embarrassing. If you spent your whole life pining to get something and then you finally got it, and you go, nah, I'm not interested. That's pathetic. That's pathetic. I'm sorry for being straight with you, but that's the only way I know how. I admire Rabbi Rosner. Some of you guys know Rabbi Rosner from Beit Shemesh? Rabbi Rosner had an unbelievable shul in Woodmere. Had a great position in YU. Gave it up to be a Rebbe in Reishit. Gave it up. Sorry, it's not nice. Gave it up to move to Eretz Yisrael. His wife was a doctor. She gave up so much to come to Eretz Yisrael. Why? Because he was tired of talking to his balabatim about the value of living in Eretz Yisrael when he was living in America. So instead of just talking about it, he actually did something. It's embarrassing that when I walk on Pico Boulevard in Los Angeles, I hear more Hebrew there than I do English. It's embarrassing. There's all these people that value, you know, Gashmias and Taiva over what's real. You have the opportunity to come home and you don't come home. So are we there yet? Is Israel there yet? Is this the land that we daven for yet? Is this V'sechazene Einenu B'shivchot Tzion Barachimim yet? The answer is no. It's not there yet. But it's in process. How could you be so obtuse as to not see the process that's going on around you? How could we be so cold as to not participate in that process?
Just add, you know, I asked my kid. Pesach time. I asked my kids, you know, what's the worst matka? If you had to choose, you know, that choice, you know, which matka don't you want besides Makas Bechoros, which is immediate death, assuming you're Bechor. But which matka wouldn't you want? And, you know, one of my kids, Arov is always up there. They're all pretty crazy, you know. But Arov is one of them that are up there. There's a medrash by Arov. That explains that when the animals came to attack and really to kill, the animals didn't just show up, you know, a monkey, a lion, a tiger, whatever came. The Medrash says they came in their environment. They came in their habitat. Meaning when the polar bear came, he didn't just come with his strength, but he was surrounded by ice. He was on ice and in the freezing cold weather. And, you know, and if you had a gorilla, he came with a monkey around. He came with a jungle around him, you know, and so on and so forth. Every animal came with their environment. And people ask in the Medrash, what's pshat? We know God won't waste the miracle. If God does a miracle, he does the miracle for a reason. So why in the world would God cause the extra miracle for this polar bear to come with the ice? Let him kill without the ice. And the answer, the Mefarshim answer, they say, pshat is because HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted the animals to be extra vicious. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted the mitzvah to get the most suffering. And God knows that when someone's in their habitat, when someone's in their home, in their environment, in the house, they will do more, they will do their job better. Home court advantage, that's what it is. The animals, when they came with their environment, it was home court advantage. Okay? Rav Mirsky says in Hegyoni Halacha, Eretz Yisrael, everyone says, but I saw it there, this is our home court advantage. Could you do well? Theoretically, you could do anywhere, But if I'm giving you advice how to succeed in life, you want that home court advantage. You want it. And not everyone could come. But everyone should try to come. And everyone should have it as a goal, as one day maybe they could come. And just remember, it's home court advantage. You know, just think sports and anything, you know. Without home court advantage, you know, might not win a championship. You know, that's pretty scary for our Judaism. Without home court advantage, who knows what your Judaism will be. So that's what it is, Chas V'Shalom, not having Eretz Yisrael.
My last question, just because I think we've covered a lot of the topics from the other questions. What is the greatest ill right now that is preventing the building of the Beis HaMikdash? You go first.
All right. So, what's the reason the Beis HaMikdash is in the air? So this is a good segue to get into going bash iPhones and the internet and this and that. But the truth is, I don't think that answers. I mean, hopefully we'll get to that. You know, in your next questions. But I put my phone away. But I think it all comes back to the source. Well, truth is not the source, actually. We all go back to the most recent destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, was the second Beis HaMikdash. The Chafetz Chaim says very simple. The Chafetz Chaim says, if you live in a generation where the Beis HaMikdash is not rebuilt, it's as if you destroyed it. What the Chafetz Chaim said, he wasn't judgmental, but the Chafetz Chaim said, Yonah, it says that you destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. He said, I destroyed it also. Edinburgh, we all destroyed it. If you live in a generation that the Beis HaMikdash has not been rebuilt, it's as if you destroyed it. And last I checked, the Beis HaMikdash has not been rebuilt. So that means is we've all destroyed it. So what does that mean? It's a very harsh statement that we destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. If you read the story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, you read the Gemaras, you always say, you idiots. Like, if only I was alive then. If only we wouldn't have had those mistakes. If I only lived during a time in the Midbar, we wouldn't have had those mistakes. But here it's saying that we are destroying the Beis HaMikdash also. So Pashup Shat, the Chafetz Chaim explains, what does it mean that you all, myself included, destroyed the Beis HaMikdash? What it means is, we all know, and you'll hear this more and more as we build up the Tisha B'Av, we all know the second Beis HaMikdash was destroyed because of Sinas Chinam. The second Beis HaMikdash was destroyed because of baseless hatred. Okay? Being a jerk. Of being mean. Okay? Of Snapchat. You know, that's what it was created for, to be a jerk. You know, why else was it created for? What else do you guys use it for? That's what it is. You know, nasty nicknames. You know, the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed for those reasons. So yes, there have been many new issues that have come up. Chil Shabbos has gotten worse. There's a new creation called Half Shabbos, and internet, all that stuff is all new. And those are issues. But I want to go to the source. The Beis HaMikdash was destroyed because of being a jerk, of being mean, Lashon Hara, okay, making fun of guys, making fun of someone, when they mess up in sports, even laughing, okay? You know, making fun of that guy who that nerd, that whatever you want to call them, okay? That's why the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. And if it hasn't been rebuilt now, that means we haven't fixed that problem. So we have many new problems, that's for sure. But let's not forget, it was destroyed for that reason. That means the reason it's not rebuilt is we haven't fixed it. And a lot of times we roll our eyes. Oh, yeah, not again. Sinas Chinam, Lashon Hara. But it's prevalent. All of you guys do it, okay? I do it also, you know? We all do it. And we all could stop a good pour. All of it? I don't know. That's, you know, I'll be honest. But we all could stop a good portion of it. And again, just think. Just think about your actions now, you know. Think about today. To do a cheshbon nefesh today of what bad jokes. You made fun of somebody, all that stuff. Just think about it and just stop that. I think that's the biggest ill. That's the biggest reason why the Beis HaMikdash is not here today.
Yeah, obviously it goes without saying that I agree. That's what the Gemara says. The Gemara says that Sinas Chinam was the reason for the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, and obviously we haven't rectified that yet. I would only add two things. There's a great article. It was written anonymously, but everyone sort of knew who it was. There's a great article that came out many years ago that said Mashiach wants to come, but he doesn't know what yarmulke to wear. Because if he wears a kippah srugah, so all the people who wear black velvet yarmulkes, they won't. He's not. He's obviously not Mashiach. He wears a kippah srugah. And if he wears a black velvet yarmulke, then all the people that wear kippot srugot, they won't join him. So Mashiach is waiting to come, But he can't figure out which yarmulke to wear. He can't figure out which shtreimel to wear, because if he wears one of those long ones that's like sort of a short brim, then he's not going to be accepted by the people that wear the tall brim shtreimels. And if he's got like a big shtreimel, then the thin one won't accept him. And if he wears a black hat, the gray hats won't accept him. And if he wears a gray hat, then the black hats won't accept him. He's a Chafetz Chaim guy. He's certainly not Mashiach. And so what we end up with is this logjam of Mashiach moving in every single direction. He goes, well, if I go to this community, nobody else will accept me. And here's an interesting thing. We all think that we're the accepting community. But when you actually stop and listen to the way that we speak about other Jews, it's terribly sad. Because I've heard so many people on all sides of the fence. These people talk about modern Orthodox people, these people talk about Haredi people, and we speak about it with this real, like, vicious, like, anger. Oh, like, people have heard this, you know, like, Haredim throw rocks at cars on Shabbos. Really? All of them? That's what they're all doing every Shabbos? Or is it some of them? Or is it maybe even just a few of them? And really, no modern Orthodox people learn Torah? There aren't serious modern Orthodox people who are pounding in YU and really becoming B'nai Torah? Or is it maybe some people that aren't being serious? But the attitude that's coming from our communities, all of our communities, like me versus you in the ring against other Jews, that's certainly not going to bring Mashiach. That's certainly not something that's going to create Achdus. In order for that to happen, we have to stop. We have to stop. Each one of us needs to be mekabel on ourselves to see other Jews with an ayin tova. You know, David HaMelech is described as having blue eyes. Why? Because it was important for the Torah to tell us that David HaMelech was good looking. That happens to be the halacha, that a king needs to be good looking. But that's what was important? No, the Alexander Rebbe says it was important for David HaMelech to have beautiful eyes, because when you have beautiful eyes, you know how to see people. That's what it means. V'sechazena einenu b'shufcha tzion merachim. Teach us how to see people again. Teach us how to look at somebody and see what's good about them. Lubavitcher Rebbe knew how to look at every single Jew that came into him b'yechidus, whether it was the Jew that was the farthest away from Yiddishkeit or his close chassidim, and he didn't see any difference between them. And he spent hours and hours. He spent, on a Sunday, when he was giving out dollars, he would sit and spend 7-8 hours at a time on his feet the entire time when he was already an older man, and he never took a bathroom break. They asked him once, how did you do that? So he didn't understand the question. He said, what do you mean? I've got Jews in front of me. How many of us could say that? How many of us could say that when we're walking through a community that we're not sitting there looking and going, oh, that guy dresses like this and that guy dresses like that? Rabbi Isai, it's a family. We want everybody to look like each other. The same way we don't want to see, when we look at each other, we don't want to see our face. When we look at another Jew, we shouldn't want to see our hashkafa. Every single one of us is different with something unique to bring to the table. And I'll finish with this maisa about my Rebbe. My Rebbe was the farthest thing from a chassid in the world. Rav Parnas was the coldest Litvak you'll ever meet in your entire life. You could bring a warm Coke to shir, and by the time you were done, that thing was freezing cold. It was like if he smiled and he made a joke in shir, you had to hold a press conference. You're talking about the coldest Litvak in the world. And a couple of years in learning by my Rebbe, he and I were very close. He said to me, you know, Mordechai, I see that my hashkafa isn't doing it for you. He would give a shmooze on Thursday, and it didn't move me. So he told me, you need to start going to Rav Moshe Weinberger. You need to start going to Rav Ephraim Waxman. And even when I was learning with my Rebbe b'chavrusa, if Rav Weinberger was doing a fabrengen or a tish or whatever, a hilula, whatever he was doing, Rav Parnas, who every minute was like, miduyak, this is the way it is, he said, Mordechai, you got to go to Rav Weinberger tonight, we'll move around our chavrusa. Why? Because he saw that I needed something different. That's a great Rebbe. Not a Rebbe who says, my hashkafa is the only way. He certainly presented his side of the argument, but then he said, you need something else. That's exceptionally pluralistic. So yes, we believe Judaism is a 70-lane highway, and as long as you're in one of the lanes, kol hakavod, good for you, you're in one of the lanes. If you're outside of one of the lanes, we've got a problem, we've got to figure out how to get you back on track. But if you're within one of the lanes, that's beautiful. And we have to start learning how to look at each other with beautiful eyes. And I don't think there's anything wrong with being judgmental in the sense of looking at somebody and saying, that's for me or that's not for me. But if you can't allow them to be them, that's the disease of all these generations since the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. And we're now going to open up the floor to you guys. David Sperver is going to be in charge of calling on you guys. What was that? The food? There is no food in front of me. Seriously.
Shkoyach.
Rav Natanel knows how to get me to come back on a Wednesday night. Is that what it was? Okay, Rabbosai, David's going to call on you guys if you have any questions.
We're going to come back in 10. We're going to be back in 10 minutes.
No. That's yours? I'm not taking your food. Okay, David's in charge of calling on people. Shh. Rabbi Sai, you'll learn as much from the questions as you will from the answers. Metz, you got courage, Metz. Spoil. How do we connect to Karbanos? That's the question. What does the word karban mean? Right. The problem with translating words in an English translation is you lose their soul. Karban means karov. That's what it means. It means to draw close. The way to draw close is to get rid of whatever feels like it's a barrier between you and God. That's what we call the animal soul. There's a godly soul and an animal soul. The sacrifice of the animal represented the destruction of the barrier that exists between me and God. So when a korban is brought, it's not simple animal slaughter for the sake of killing a goat. It's not like TABC hockey that needs to shecht anything that's relatively connected to Ramaz. You know what I'm saying? Like, now I'm really going to get in trouble from Sariel. No, it wasn't a random activity. It was the recognition that there was an aveira that was done that came from a place that's not really who I am, and I need to get rid of that in my life. So we can absolutely still do that whether there's a Beis HaMikdash or not. Now, if you really want just a simple Eitzah, it's a beautiful thing to say Karbanos every day. And Chazal say that if you say it, it's like you're a makriv it. So if you want a simple way of connecting to the Karbanos, so say it. But as Rav Braunschweigel used to say to me, I have an even better idea. So mean it. Next question. David.
How far...
Loud, so everyone can hear it.
How far, to what extent does legitimate reasons cannot make Aliyah? What would you consider a legitimate reason?
So it's a great question. He's asking what's a legitimate reason, if there are any, why not to live in Israel. It's a halacha and hashkafa question. I'll begin to answer. Kabir Berg will want to answer also, but it's a discussion. It's a great question. So the classic reasons, if I remember correctly, of why we say one does not have to live in Israel is, number one reason is for parnasa. If you can't make money here, then that's a reason not to live in Israel. But there's a debate, what does it mean not to make money? I mean, you might say, oh, I need to make, you know, $3 million. But you can make whatever here, and that's a question you have to ask. So that's one money. I would add also, just from my own personal experience, making Aliyah, it's chinuch, it's raising your children. Okay, if you can't raise your children the way that you want to raise them, assuming you want to raise them the Torah way, as great as Eretz Yisrael is, there are challenges, there are difficulties in many parts of the Aliyah process, and one of the more famous ones is chinuch for your kids. So just add that a lot of people want to rush to Eretz Yisrael, but they forget that you're coming with a team, with a wife and kids. And while the learning might be better for you, it might not necessarily be the best for them. And again, so I would say is that you have to. I would recommend is that it should be something that you should want to do and look into. But the two issues I'll bring up now is one is money, and two is I guess your own personal frumkeit and your children's. Is that if that's not going to work, then why are you coming? I mean, they have stories where certain rabbanim wanted to make aliyah, but they were told by even bigger gedolim saying, no, they need you here. You know, you have a certain role there. So again, it's a halacha question. You really have to ask. That's very subjective. But those are the two quick things that come to my mind.
The Gemara says parnasa, Torah, and marriage. Those are the three reasons that you could live in Chutz Laretz. If you can't make a parnasa here, you can't find a wife here, let's say that includes you can't raise a family here, and your Torah is going to be better in America. And you tell me, you can't find Torah in Eretz Yisrael today? You can't find a wife in Eretz Yisrael today? Even if you found a wife back in Stern, you'll figure out how to get her across the ocean, yeah? And, you know, they go to Stern to get their MRS. You know what that stands for? Their misses. They go to get married, yeah? And, and Parnassa you'll find. Parnassa you'll find. Everyone's hocking me at Chinik. You can't find the Parnassa. You can't find the Parnassa. I have two brothers that live here, and they're making a great Parnassa. You know what else? I don't understand how your parents pay $25,000 tuition a year in America. That's crazy. So you're going to tell me you can't find a job, even if you find a job in America that's paying you $150,000 a year. Your tuition bill. Because, again, especially remember, if you're making $200,000, $250,000 a year, they're not giving you a tuition break. It's not like these schools are making money. So you're talking about a $100,000 tuition bill if you've got four kids. That's crazy. After taxes, after your mortgage, after insurance, you're basically poor. If you're going to be poor, you may as well live here. At least you'll be with other impoverished people.
So,
loud, so everyone can hear.
For the people in Klal Yisrael who don't exactly agree with the state of Israel, what's their thesis? Exactly.
Who agrees with the state of Israel? Who agrees with the state of Israel? Let's actually lay it out. Do we have an observant state? We do not. Do we have a state that gave back the Gush? That gave back Gush Katif? The answer is yes. So, to the right and to the left, in Yiddishkeit, very few people actually agree with the state of Israel. I'll tell you an old joke. This is a terrible joke. They asked the Minister of Finance of Israel. They said, how come Israel is such a poor country when Jews all over the world are so rich? So he said, Jews are like manure. When you spread it out all over the place, it makes things grow. But if you put it in one place, it just stinks. You know, asking me how Jews could disagree about something is like asking me how you could be Jewish. You know, two Jews, three opinions. What they're basically saying is, let's take the most extreme. Let's take the Satmar approach. The Satmar approach, based on a Gemara that talks about the Gimel Shvuos, says that we really shouldn't conquer Eretz Yisrael before Mashiach comes. That's the simple reading of the Gemara. There's probably about 30 different ways of reading that Gemara, but they are taking a literal approach to it. The Satmar Rebbe was a Goyin Olam and a Gadol B'Torah who none of us should be mezalzelim. But that was his approach for his chassidim, and they did their thing. That's why they took a radicalized approach. Then you have, let's say, the more mainstream Haredi approach that basically says, look, it's not the government we want. We'll vote, we'll pay taxes, and we're gonna fight and sort of like move this to the direction that we want. Then you have, let's say, the Dati Lumi community that also basically says it's not what we want, but we're going to fight and do it maybe in a little bit of a different way, maybe in a more embracive way to try to make those changes. And then you have people on the left that are miserable because they're not nice enough to the Arabs. So, it's a work in progress. It's a baby country. Chever, this country is 70 years old. By the time America was 70 years old, they had enslaved all the black people from Africa. You really can't see that we're in process? America didn't give the women the vote. okay, we're not there yet. We're not there yet. Everybody says that. Except for Satmar, everybody basically says that. I want to tell you something. Most Haredim, they're not anti-Zionist. It's just not what's going on for them in their life. They're just trying to get through the day like most of us. They're trying to put food on the table, have a job, do whatever comes to them. They're not angry, they're not anti, despite whatever you read in the newspapers, and despite whatever Mishagayim you see that are throwing rocks or setting garbages on fire. It's not most people. It's not most people. It's really not. But I'll put it right back to you. Yeah, all those people that are couch potato Zionists that are marching in the Israeli Day Parade just so that they can get to the concert at the end and see the girls from whatever way, you know what I'm saying? Just because they're pro-Israel doesn't mean they're actually doing anything about it. They're paying lip service to it. So again, if we're going to have the conversation, let's be authentic about it. Move to Israel. Move to Israel and then let's have that conversation. I got into a fight with my mother many, many years ago. And we were having a conversation exactly about this. What's a proper hashkafa when it comes to the state of Israel? And my mother and I got into a big argument. My parents, I grew up in Lawrence. I said to my mother, I said, are you really fighting with me about this? We live in Lawrence, in like a really nice house in Lawrence. And 3 days later, my mother told me she was making Aliyah. So I was like, are you really making Aliyah to win the argument? Like, that's crazy. She's like, no, you were right. We should have lived in Israel. We made a mistake. I stayed here for your grandmother, but you know what? We should go. And I was like, okay, I thought it was just more talk. It's not actually going to happen. Then they went and bought a house in Israel. So I was like, okay, it'll be like one of those like five towns investments in Israel. You know, they come three times a year, so they only need to keep one day. I didn't actually think that it was going to be a serious thing. I see all the Teaneck people laughing. They're like, why'd you buy a house? We got one day from Rabbi Adler. Anyway, the... it's the Chacham Tzvi. And then they started getting my sister like tutoring lessons. Like, we're going to teach her Hebrew because she's going to be in fifth grade when we make Aliyah. And I was like, you're really wasting your money at this point. You don't really need to win the argument. I know what's going on. And then they went. And like at the airport, it finally occurred to me, like as they were boarding their Nefesh B'Nefesh flight, I'm like, holy cow, you guys are actually making Aliyah. And then I was stuck in America. And I'm like, what am I doing here? So then I made Aliyah. Shortly thereafter, about 2 years after that, I made Aliyah. Maybe two, 3 years after that, I made Aliyah. And then my brother was in America, and he's like, what am I doing here? Everyone's over there. So he made Aliyah. Then my other brother was living in America. He's like, what am I doing here? So as soon as he finished YU, he had like a year or two of working under his belt. So he made Aliyah. Now my entire family lives in Israel. And yes, it is hard for my mother, because my grandmother, who's Kanayin Ahara, 87 years old, she still lives back. And she goes back about 45 days a year. She's just getting back tomorrow from another trip where she went just to check in on my grandmother. And you know what? It is legitimately hard. But my parents, they put up or shut up. They said, we're not going to do this anymore. We're going to live in Eretz Yisrael and we're going to make a difference. And yes, we live in Beit Shemesh, which is like right next to the five towns. But you know, you don't make fun of the Russians for moving to a Russian community. You don't make fun of the Ethiopians for living in an Ethiopian community. And Americans have an awesome opportunity now to move either to a neighborhood that's more Israeli, where they're going to feel, let's say, they're integrating their kids more, or to a more American community where they have that comfortability. And if that's what works for you, you have those options now. This is not 1948 where you're making, you know, Aliyah to the Merkaz Klita and Mevaseret and living like in a hovel for 2 years before you can even get citizenship. It's not what we're talking about anymore. It's comfortable to make Aliyah. So there's really very, again, I'm sorry to be pushing this agenda. We could talk about these fights as if it's a reason not to come, or if that's, even if it's really important, which it's not. Most people are just trying to make it through. But the bottom line is, if you have an opinion, so do something about it. Fair? Next question, David. Right here.
How do we respect Jews that are part of the Detroit cartel, which may be very far as
The Ture Karta is the only thing that makes the Israeli Day Parade fun. I mean, how do you respect them? That's the greatest gift in the world.
You told me it was the girls' school, man.
Yeah, well, it's both. It's the beginning. The Israeli Day Parade is important because of the bookends. The beginning with the Ture Karta and the end with the girls at the concert. That's the whole thing. You're just walking from one destination to the next. You're all laughing because you know I'm right.
So I'll tell you. Meaning, if you would have phrased the question as, you know, Hasidim or Haredim, there'd be a different answer. But again, now's not the time to bash. But within the Turek Harta, I'm sure there are also different sects that more extreme or not. But I hate to say it, there's certain things. There are certain groups of Judaism, and I think I'm a Haredi. I think I'm a firm guy overall. I think maybe, yeah. So I'm trying. I'm struggling. An adult at risk. But there are certain things that turn me off. Also, there are certain things that I have no answer for. And you could start going. Rabbi Berg mentioned there's a Gemara. The Satmars go by, and it could be they go by that Gemara also. You could go by that. I don't mean this in a judgmental way. I don't mean it in an anger way. I don't think I judge them. I don't think I have anger towards them, but I'm not like goris them, which is a pretty harsh statement to make. Like I don't take their opinion with this seriously at all. And some of them might be good people, and some of them could be great scholars, much greater than myself. But there's certain I don't understand. I feel your pain. There are certain things that really, really bother me. That's one of them. If you would have phrased it as Haredim and Hasidim, I think Rabbi Berg touched upon this, and that is, I would say the group is much smaller than you realize. I've been through. I live in Ramat Beit Shemesh. You live in Beit Shemesh. We've seen this is bad stuff. Huh? Yeah, I've seen some horrible stuff. You know, I drive the Route 10 a lot because of that. But I'll tell you, and those things turn me off, and I guess I do have anger. I'm not going to lie, okay? It's true. Okay, I have anger, you know? And certain things really bother me. But as frustrated as I am, a lot of these protests that I got stuck in literally for like hours, let's say, over a few times, I got stuck over an hour in these protests. A lot of times, it's just a few kids. So I'm not where those kids' parents, I have no clue, you know? And why are those kids doing it, and why are people...
Most of the time, it's they're
the representatives
of the community.
No, it's not fair. Listen.
How many people live in that community?
A lot.
Yeah, one second. How many people? It's not 10,000, right? It's much, much more than that. You're probably talking about 100,000 people. They're terrified. They're terrified of them. They're really scared of them. And it's certainly okay for you to be frustrated at those people that are doing terrible things. But it's not fair for you to call them representatives of their community. Just like it's not fair for me to talk about anybody in any community as the minority being for the entire community. I really understand being frustrated by them. I live in that same neighborhood and it's terrible. And when my friends are walking through that neighborhood and people are calling them like Goyim and things like that, that's terrible. That's terrible. But I want you to know that there are many, many, many people, the silent majority, that are living in fear of those people. They're living in fear of them. You don't understand. Rav Yashiv was the Gadol Hador. Do you know when Rav Yashiv spoke out against these people? They egged his base medrash for weeks on end. They have no respect for Rabbanim. You think that they're representatives of their community. Believe me, they're not. There are people that literally, when there was a big incident, and my parents, who are clearly Tzioni people, were walking down the block, people were coming out of their apartment building and apologizing to them for what was going on. They said, please understand, this is not the community. It's not. It really isn't. And the fact that we don't have to stand up and say, I don't agree, let's say, with spitting on a little girl. If you don't know that spitting on a little girl is wrong, there's nothing that I'm going to be able to do to convince you of that. You know what I'm saying? But I promise you, they are not the representatives of that community. And I would encourage you to get involved and to talk to them. I want you to know, one of the things that I did 2 years ago is I actually walked there on Shabbos and I started...
to cut down 50%.
You're not right. You're not right, and it's sad that you believe that, because I want you to know, I actually did go to that community for about 6 months. I went to different shuls there. And I want you to know that they treated me with tremendous respect. I want you to know that very Haredi Rabbanim has spoken to my wife, and it's Rav Asher Weiss, who's certainly one of the most Haredi Rabbanim in Yerushalayim. Absolutely. Somebody just told me today, he talks to the wives all the time, he calls them by their first name. Again, you have and I don't blame you for having this, because the community rhetoric is what you're saying. But it's really not true, it's rhetoric. And I would encourage you to consider that your rhetoric might not be right. The same way that I would encourage anybody on the other side to say that their rhetoric about our community might not be right. But it really is just that, it's just rhetoric. The only way we're going to get to peace is if we stop talking from that place of I know I'm right and you're wrong, and actually see the other people. Most of them, they really are not sitting there thinking about you and going, I hate you, you're a guy. Yes, some lunatics are. But that does not represent the community, I promise you. I promise you. I'm sorry for being so stark, but you guys got to hear this on both sides of the fence. We will never come to shalom as long as this rhetoric is out there. This rhetoric is destructive. Sorry for cutting you off, Roy Bromfield.
How does the average high school teenager in America walk the line between like trying to branch out a little bit towards Hasidus and being surrounded by a lot of misnagdish type of philosophies?
Hasidus is beautiful. There's no reason to have to walk the line. It's people are entitled to their opinion, but if you find yourself drawn to that, kol hakavod to you. I don't think you have to walk the line, is what I'm telling you. You don't have to fight with anybody, but it's not... I really don't think that it's something that you have to be embarrassed of. If that's what gets you from one shacharis to one mincha to one ma'ariv, for one day, it was worth it, the entire project was worth it. And if that speaks to you, why would anybody tell you that you shouldn't do what works for you in Yiddishkeit because it's not what they agree with? That's sick.
Sorry.
Yeah. No, building that point is, you know, Judaism has to be, keep it real. Okay, Judaism has to be real.
And, you know, I've already mentioned before, from the heart, you know, it has to come from your heart. And you have, as long as you're keeping it real, who cares, you know? You have to be excited about Judaism, as that's the biggest thing we lack. And, you know, Rav Shimshon Pinkus, that's all. I'm not sure if you've got Nefesh Shimshon, Sharm the Tefillah, if you read his Svarim. He has an unbelievable sefer about Emunah. And I would say most of it is it's a Hashkafic sefer. I would say it has a Hasidish, you know, I guess Hasidish Torah. Rav Pinkus says, you know, and you would think that he's a little, you know, Hasidish. But Rav Pinkus in that sefer, again, it's an awesome sefer, and he writes the whole sefer, and he goes through all these Hasidish ideas and these Kabbalistic ideas that people equate to be Hasidish. But in the sefer, he says, you know, for me personally, if you want to have Emunah, he goes, I'll open up a Baba Basra. I'll open up a Baba Metziah. That's the way I'll get my Emunah, through learning Torah. He goes, others don't. What you have to worry about is what works for you. And for some, you can open up a Gemara, and you can connect that way, and that's great. Personally, for me, that doesn't do it for the Emunah aspect. For a different aspect, you know, that I need, without Gemara, I'm nothing. But for Emunah, I need those other Sfarim. But whatever you connect to, you should be proud of, and you should do it. Do not look over your shoulder. This is one of the things you have a Rebbe for, to direct you in that way. And, but like Berg said, that you should never, the same way, we shouldn't peg other people. Oh, he's Hasidish. Oh, he's Litvak. He's that. Don't do that to yourself either. You know, you should feel you should have a self-confidence and ability to, I don't want to say, it's not picking and choosing, because it's all the same area, but you should go your way. One day this works, that server works for you, great. A different day, and just do it. And again, that makes real Jews. You know, that's what, if you want to become a real Jew, you're a Jew who could open up a Mrs. Sharma Connect, a Gemara to Connect, a Rambam, whatever it is, and we need more of those.
It's Chazanish. There's an entire sefer on that topic. I don't know if we're going to touch it tonight. This is Chazanish. Is literally a sefer from the Chazanish called Emunah v'Bitachon, and he discusses that question at length. It's worthwhile to see inside. The question was, what's the difference between Emunah and Bitachon? But the question is too large for tonight. It's at least a 30-hour topic.
So, suppose you wake up one morning and you realize that, like, you go through your day without really, like, having, like, this constant knowledge of the Kodesh Baruch Hu. Like, you go to davening, you run out after a Bala Tzion, you don't really learn too much. You go to work, and then your day is just whatever, and then you go to sleep at night, and then that's it. And then you want to have that connection, but it's just very difficult. How do you, like, talk yourself out of it? Like, you could say, oh, learn 5 minutes every day, and then grow from there, but, like, it's difficult to make that first step. What do you do from there?
Talking about someone struggling in the Judaism, what?
Like you want to, like for sure, like being on Tzitzis Barkol, you really get that love of that's what I want to be. I want to be that kind of person. But it's not like you reject it, but you struggle reaching that goal.
Listen, you're asking the million, billion dollar. I mean, this is the biggest question that we struggle with. We all, you know, chinuch wise, we struggle, and personally, we all struggle with this. You know, how to keep that fire going? How to stay from? You know, I mean, everyone says youth at risk. You know, there's more adults at risk. You know, who are going through the motions. You know, it's a big issue, and there's no simple answer for sure. You know, there's no one quick answer. I would say is that if you want, I mean, you mentioned something of learning 5 minutes a day of pushing yourself. You know, that's something that I highly recommend for guys to try to, you know, if you're not happy where you are, try to break out of that classic schedule. And I'll add one thing, as I was thinking before, sorry, I blanked out, is that right now you're on Ansi Sui Kola. I hope for most of you you're in a great zone religiously. I hope. That's the goal. I don't want to say it's easy, but I will. You know, here it's easy. I'll say it with great Rebbeim. I'm saying I am the Rebbe Heverberg, you know, and you know, it's again, I'm generalizing a little bit, but here it's easy. Okay, overall, here it should be much easier. You should be at a peak of your Jewish year. If you come to, you know, Ansi Sui Kola, this is what summer for you?
Third.
the third summer. So I would hope that this summer, you know, that this is where you get all the spiritual power for the rest of the year. That's what I hope. This is easy or easier. What I recommend to all of you is when you hit a certain peak, when things are good in Judaism, write yourself a letter. You could type it. You could type yourself a letter. A Rebbe of mine told this to me years ago. It was before the computer age. I wrote myself a letter. Write yourself a letter when things are good. And talk to yourself. And say, you know, say, Reuven, yeah, you're talking to yourself. Things are great. Things are good. My Shabbos is X, Y, and Z. My davening is X, Y, and Z. My learning is X, Y. And this is why. Write yourself a letter. And say, give yourself chizik. In this letter, you're going to get, if God forbid, Shabbos is not the same, I highly recommend doing this. Do this svarim, speak to this Rebbe. Write yourself this letter. Okay, this is the best advice I could give you guys. Write yourself a letter about what's going well, if God forbid things aren't going well, how to deal with it, and then put this letter away. And you should never take it out. You should, you know, whether you print it up, you keep it in your computer files. Open in case of emergency. You don't want to play around with it. This could really save you, you know? Open in case of emergency. And during the year, when you find those struggles, if you open this and you'll go back and see, you'll see what was going so well, that could be, you know, that could be a big help. There's this baseball player, John Olerud. I'm not sure if any of you guys, anyone heard of him? Mets, yeah. But we know where he was before the Mets? Blue Jays, nice. Okay, good. Yeah, so John Olerud, okay? So you Google him. So John, I know him. I was a big Met fan, and was, not this year. And what's it, there's always hope. So the so John Olerud, he won, I'm not sure it was one or two, but there was a Tkufa. There were a good 3-4 years where he's one of the best hitters in the MLB. I think he won the batting title. And but there was a time, I might have been when he was on the Mets, where he was struggling. And he was in a bad slump, as we call it. Okay, this is your question, you know? What do you know, things go well, then you get in a slump. And he got in a baseball slump, a swinging slump. So obviously, he had a trainer. Obviously, he worked hard. But what he said was, I read a great article. He said what got him out of his slump, what he did was, he watched the year, those his golden years, those best years. He watched those old videos. He watched his swing. He went over his daily routine from that year. He went over his eating habit. He went over everything. Because those were the glory years. And when he tapped into that, when he did that, he said he got back into his groove again. So that's what I'm still a havdil. That's what I'm saying now. If things are clear now, I hope they're clear now. Write yourself a letter. Before the summer ends, write yourself this letter. Do it on Tisha B'Av. Okay? You can't learn. Write yourself a letter. And then have this letter once a year, maybe when things, if God forbid, things get tough, open it up. And you'll see that, you know, there are many great Musa Sfarim there, but you give yourself the best advice.
I would only add one thing. It's not supposed to be easy. Marriage is not easy, but you stick with it. Raising kids is not easy, but you stick with it. Judaism is not easy, but you stick with it. As long as you're in the ring, you're winning. If you're out, then you're out. But as long as you're in the ring, as long as you keep coming at it, if you had 2 weeks off, 3 weeks off, 4 weeks off, somebody was just telling me today, a very chashuv Rebbe was telling me that when he came to yeshiva for the year, the first 2 weeks he didn't even put on tefillin. He didn't put on tefillin. And he was in a good yeshiva. He just didn't even put on tefillin. But he was struggling. He was struggling. And he stayed with it. Today he's a Rebbe. Very chashuv Rebbe. Somebody that if I told you his name, you would all go, no way. He's a very, very chashuv Talmud Chacham. Just stay in it. It's not supposed to be that you're always on fire about your Judaism. That would be a little weird. Oh, Rav Bromfield and I always joke around, there's a certain Rebbe that he's like way too in love with his wife. And it's uncomfortable for people to be around them. Because like if he's on the phone with her like and they're like hanging up, he's like, no, you hang up first. No, you hang up first. I love you more. No, I love you more. And Rav Bromfield, I'm like, please be quiet. You know, like, and he's like, whatever. He's way, way, way in love with his wife. And that's awesome, but it's also a little weird. Right? Because most of us are in love with our wives, but like, I don't know, it's a certain natural tendency to marriage that like it sort of evens out. You're not like on fire anymore. It's deep like water. It's not passionate like fire. Still meaningful, but it's a different type of fight. So you could start taking your wife for granted. Is that a bad thing? Obviously. But it also means that there's like a reality to it, you know? So it would be weird if like you were 40 years old and still like, I don't know, maybe shuckling like, you know, when you were like 16 years old, when you look like you're having a seizure, just to impress the girls on the other side of the mechitza. That'd be a little weird, you know what I'm saying? At some point, you should like be more sort of, it should be more natural to you. And yes, we then fall into the danger that Rabbi Bronfeld is talking about, where it's like, is this really going to be something that I care about, or is it going to be social Judaism? I show up to shul like it's a country club. But as long as you're in the fight, I cannot tell you this enough. Nobody is trying to get you to any community in Judaism. We don't care what community you're part of. It really doesn't matter to us. What matters to us is that you're part of a community of people that are passionate about Judaism, and that you're a contributing member of that community. Know what I mean?
David.
First of all, Chaim Kanievsky wasn't the first person to do that. There's a Tshuvas HaRambam where the Rambam says that you shouldn't predict when Mashiach is coming, and then the Rambam predicts when Mashiach is coming. So we've been doing this throughout history. So number one, nobody is saying like he's going to come by this date. Torah already tells us that, you know, Yaakov Avinu was, he wanted to reveal when Mashiach was going to come, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't let him. So nobody knows when Mashiach is going to come. That's number one. Number two, that Maimer Chazal that says that Mashiach is going to come by the year 6000, you have to understand for two things. Number one, the world is divided into three parts. The history of the world is divided into three parts. 2,000 years of Tohu Vavohu, 2,000 years of Torah, 2,000 years of Mashiach. Now, we know that the 2,000 years of Torah actually started in the year 1948 with Avram Avinu. Just like every child has a growth period, but there's certain points that are like the transition periods. So towards the end of the year, getting closer to 2000, Avram Avinu started to bring in that next stage of Torah, which obviously peaked and culminated with Moshe Rabbeinu. And then again, in the last 2,000 years, again, one could talk about the advent of Hasidus and all that, but in the last 2,000 years, we could start to see that there's a radical change that's coming into the world now, and we could see that we're already in Mashiach Zayin. All the Gedolim have told us that. Now, in the year 6,000, if Mashiach isn't here yet, that means nothing to me. The same way that Torah didn't come in the year 2000 exactly. It's part of a process. And I heard, and this is the second thing I heard from B'Shem, I won't say B'Shem was a particular gadol, he said if on year, you know, day one of the year 6000 Mashiach's not going to be here, I still haven't lost one bit of iota, one bit of emunah. Our Pesach Halacha comes from the Rambam, we hold of the Rambam's Yud Gimel Ikrim, and the Rambam says that we have a chiyuv to believe that Mashiach will come, and it's a long process, and we wait patiently but longingly for Mashiach. That's our chiyuv. So, when everyone tells me like, oh, we're getting closer. Yeah, Seder, we're getting closer. Good. And God willing, is going to be here very soon. In terms of your chiyuv, all you need to believe is that Mashiach is coming, which by the way is a very natural thing. Redemption is a natural part of the world. Mashiach is not something external to the world. He's the natural process of redemption. Everything in your life gets redeemed at some point. Every broken thing gets fixed. Right? So that's what Mashiach is. It's a natural process.
I'll tell you guys a story. It's true. I think it's a true story that happened in the year 2448. Okay, we said Avram was born in the year of 1948. We're holding the year 5777. So year 2448, there's a guy Moses. Okay, true story. Moshe comes from Midian and he gathers the elders of the Jews, and they go in some tent, some cave, some little hut, and he says, "I've been sent by God to let you free. God will free you, but I'm the messenger." This is a true story. It's in the Torah. I'm the messenger to lead you to freedom. They said, "Great, Moshe, that Moses, that's awesome, that's great, but like, what's your proof?" So Moshe gave him two signs. Number one, Moshe did the miracle of the staff. He took the staff, he threw it down, turned to a snake. I think he actually also did Dam. He did a few miracles to prove himself. But Moshe also gave them the secret password. There was a secret password that Yosef, when Yosef died, and the Bereishis, Yosef said to the elders, in X amount of years, there will be a prophet that will come to you. And he uses these words, you'll know it's legit. You guys know those words? Pakot Pakadati. So Moshe did the sign, and what did he do? He also said the secret words. Okay? Whoa, we're being saved. So this part now, I'm not sure if it's that part is true. But I truly believe there must have been a few people in the back of the room. Gantrell's sitting, yeah? A few people in the back of the room. And they're like, wait a second, Moses. listen, it's pretty impressive you did a miracle. It's pretty impressive you knew the secret password. But there's a big problem here. What's that problem? That God told Avraham Avinu that we're going to be slaves in Egypt for how long? 400 years. And Moshe, you are 190 years early. So do me a favor. Don't let the door hit you on the way out. Get out of here, Moshe. You're fake. You're a phony. Okay? I think that part of the story is true. They said, Moshe, you're a phony. You must have overheard the password. You must be doing some magic sorcery. These tricks aren't real, right? Get out of here, Moshe. You're 190 years early. So what's the answer to the question? There are many answers. I know two famous ones. Yeah, how do we get out 190 years early if God, the Torah says, you'll be there for 400, God says it. It wasn't some prophet, it was God. God said 400 years, we were only there 290. How is it possible, yeah? How do we get out, 190 years early? What's pshat? So there's two answers. One, the most famous answer is, the counting wasn't from Egypt, the counting was from Yitzchak Levi, that's one answer. Sorry, it's boring, but we'll get to the cool part in a second, yeah? The other answer I've heard, again, many answers I've heard is that the Egyptians worked the Jews like 400 years. In those 210 years, it was so harsh, it felt like 400 years. Those are two answers to a great question. Why am I telling you this great, awesome story? It's to answer your question. When people start the year 6000, and the year, and you could go through Navi and find many different prophecies. What you see from the story I told you is that God could say 400, and it could be 400, or it could be like 400, or accounting from the wrong time. You know, as Berg said with the 1948, 2000, meaning that's just the biggest proof, which we all know. We don't deny that story I just told you. Moshe came 190 years early, but what happened? We were let free. So basically, the way I love to say this over is, you know what? God has the prophecies. Don't worry how Mashiach will come. Will he come tomorrow? I hope so. Will he come by the year 6000? I better hope so, you know. And even if he comes afterwards, what's with that Gemara? Don't worry. We see time and time again. People who play with history are controlled by history. Do what we have to do, and we will live the history that we're supposed to be living. So I'll say that story I'm not familiar with. I mean, I've heard beautiful stories that I know certain yeshivas that actually canceled their vacation, you know, during that Gaza war. I'm not denying your story. I don't know. I'm not familiar with that story. But I'll tell you, you know, the truth is, you know, Rav Berg was tough on the... Oh, that guy. Uh-oh. Yeah. So, yeah. Meaning, I don't want to say I disagree, but... But you know, I'm cynical. I'm plenty cynical. You know, I read some article today, Connections Magazine. It's a really great magazine, and the police chief, who's a frum guy, said some horrible story. I get cynical. I get angry. I do. Before I was denying it, I do. Certain things really tick me off. Okay, and it's not easy. It's definitely not easy. But I'll say for myself. Okay, number one is. The number one thing for yourself is that as frustrated as I get, that should never affect my Judaism. Meaning, I can't stand people like, you know, you ask somebody, why you're from, the Haredim are doing this, the Haredim are doing that. It kills me that Haredim might be doing that, but it hurts me more that you're using it, not you, that one would use that as an excuse. So I would say, again, it's not easy to not get ticked off. It's very easy to get ticked off, you know? And I myself, I get very frustrated a lot about it. But the big thing is that that's never an excuse for you. Either way, you have to keep Shabbos. Either way, you gotta daven. You got to be Shomer Negiah. Okay, oh, Rabbi, I'm not Shomer Negiah because I read some... Okay, please, Shkoyach. Okay, the alarm didn't over here. Yeah. But that's a bit... It's not easy. I've answered again. A lot of times, it's like you said, it's a minority, and don't forget, it's definitely true, but it's definitely enough that it's out there. But the big thing I say to you is never use that as an excuse for Judaism. Never, you know, I know I've heard horrible stories about Satmar. I've heard it, okay. But, however, you know, I heard this from somebody, a big Tzion, he said this to me, you know, I hate to use that term as to define someone's Judaism based on that, but a person who's a very, very big Tzioni, a big Zionist, said to me, as much as the things of the Israeli Day Parade might have upset him about the Satmar, he said, I'm not sure if it was his mother, because his mother was in NYU hospital with cancer, the Bikur Cholim of the Satmar, he says, they saved her life. You know, not just bringing the food, help, you know, the love, the care, the sitting there reading books and talking. So so basically to sum it up is, it is frustrating, realize it's a minority, there is plenty good going on there, but the most important thing is, it should never affect your Judaism. And if you're using that to affect your Judaism, it's an excuse, and you got to stop that.
Where do you live? Do you mind me asking? Yeah. Teaneck. And if somebody came to you and said, in Teaneck, people aren't serious about their Limud HaTorah or their Halacha, how would you respond? No, somebody's coming and I'm coming. Let's say I'm coming. I would never do this. But let's say I came and I said, you know, in Teaneck I heard there's like a football league in the park on Shabbos. And people are playing football on Shabbos in shorts and t-shirts and doing whatever. Uvda Dechol on Shabbos. And I heard that people aren't serious about their learning. They talk too much in davening. How would you respond to that? I'm the person. How would you respond to that? No, I'm talking about the community. Oh, right. Just like I can't come and talk about Teaneck that way, and it would be wrong of me, because Teaneck has a lot of really beautiful things going on. It's an ear of chesed. It's a huge ear of chesed. And there are some things that we can look at and disagree with. But it certainly shouldn't define our approach to the community. That's the way of doing it. I can be pluralistic because I can love both. Yes. Yes, we have to get rid of this rhetoric. Yes, I was harsh before. I don't take it back. On both sides of the fence. When Haredi people come to me and want to bash the modern Orthodox community, Rav Schechter, Rav Tversky, I mean, come on, NCSY Kola, we're doing unbelievable things here. When people come to me and they want to bash the Haredi community, come on, they're doing unbelievable things there. So yes, there are problems on all sides of the fence. Congratulations, we found the holes. This is not going to heal the patient. The patient is sick. The disease is sinas chinam. Sitting and finding all the flaws in every side and not looking for the beauty, I promise you this will not bring Mashiach. That's why I was harsh before. I'm not harsh before because I'm anti or pro one community or the other. I'm pro HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I love Jews and I'm trying to keep us together. It's fair answer? Now, Dave.
What are the really the parameters, I guess, of interaction between boys and girls, especially in NCSY, code environments, etc.? I mean, I remember reading once put it like the Moshe Feinstein but in general, like, I think there's a lot of different like bands and a lot of different things. What are really the mostly the issue? How does it really work?
The Shiloh was about boys and girls. Abe, are you talking about at this age? Are you talking about at this age? Okay, Chevra, it's a very simple equation. Intimacy means exclusivity. Right, we can all agree to that. Intimacy means exclusivity. I'm not married to two people, I'm not married to three people, I'm married to one person. Now the question is, what does exclusive mean? So let's break it down. Does exclusive mean that I won't talk to any other woman? And if I even talk to another woman, that makes me somebody who's not treating my wife exclusively? Some of us might say that's extreme. Happens to be Allah brought down in Shulchan Aruch, but we're not going to deal with that right now. Let's say somebody says, no, it's when you're friends with another person. Talking is fine, but if you really become friendly with another woman while you're married, that's a problem. Some people will say, no, that's not a problem. Even, it's when you start to touch each other, then it becomes a problem. And then we start to talk about, well, how long is touch? Right? How long is it when touch lingers? Right? It's a little, we're talking about important things. We're talking about how do we keep marriage sanctified.
Right? When you look around in the world today, we see that it's no longer sanctified. Now, the reason I'm talking about marriage is because you guys, maybe you're sitting here at 15, 16, 17 years old going, Rebbe, what are you talking about? I'm not married. Yeah, you're not married yet. But you are setting yourself up to be married. So what's it going to look like by your wedding? You're going to have your kala walking down the aisle, and you're going to be like looking at her like, wow, this is the woman I'm going to spend the rest of my life with. And then you have all your friends that you grew up with, all those girls hanging out on the side going, we're so happy for you. And what does it look like when you pick up the phone right after Sheva Brachos, the phone rings, and your wife picks it up, and she goes, hello. And it's this girl that you were friends with in high school, and she's like, I'm so sorry to do this to you. I'm like in the middle of a crisis. Can I speak to your husband? And so, and she goes, yeah, of course, no problem. Speak to my husband, of sure. And then you get on the phone with her and you say to your wife, your brand new wife, I know that we were supposed to hang out together tonight, but she really needs me. And then you go to the other room and close the door and spend 2 hours on the phone with her. Right? So some of you are laughing, but how do you think that happens? Right? It happens because we set ourselves up like this. And the question is, what is the... Everything has a cost. So the question is, when you analyze the cost benefit of this relationship, right, what is it adding on to your life and what is the detraction of your life? The more you diminish exclusivity from intimacy, the less intimacy you'll have. So the question is, at what point you want to start? Full disclosure, again, I can't speak about Rabbi Bromfeld, but I have my feeling that he also probably spoke to girls in high school. Probably. I can't speak for you.
It's 3 weeks embarrassing.
It's the 3 weeks and I'm embarrassing. Oh, Rabbi, this guy for sure had game, but the... trying to build him up. The captain of MCA hockey.
Ooh.
Anyway,
short-handed goal.
And he's scored in the championship?
Lost.
Lost in the championship, so like, you know, whatever. The yeah, full disclosure, the hardest part about being married is not treating your wife like your high school girlfriend. Your high school girlfriend is your high school girlfriend. She's somebody you walk down the street with. I'm sure you care about her, but there's something that you walk down the street with and you go like, check it out, look who I'm with. When you're married, it's much more meaningful than that. It's a person you're raising a family with. It's a person you're dedicating your life to towards building something special. The only question is when you're going to start that process. Yes, I knew my wife in high school. I met her when I was 15. It's a true story. I met her when I was 15 years old. She also broke up with me for a couple of years in between because she was much smarter than me. And she said, listen, we each have to become the person that we're going to become because we're having a huge impact on each other. So let's break up and let's really get like separated from each other for a couple of years. And if in the end we get back together, so then great. And I was very blessed that it happened to me that at the end of that process, we were able to get back together. But the greatest gift that my wife gave me at that time was telling me, go take a couple of years for yourself. See who you become. I'm going to do the same and let's see if we're there at the end. And we're not exactly the same. We were close enough. You know what I mean? But that was the greatest gift she gave me. I feel bad. Sklar's had his hand up for like 20 minutes.
You
were? Yeah, Sklar. Yeah.
Okay, so what kind of rabbi do you think a typical Talmud, you think like needs to strive in Judaism? Like one that develops a kesher and like tries to be a friend, or one that's strict and doesn't mess around?
I don't think there's a... Well, if you want to use the examples you have, you know what I'm saying? I don't think... I'll start like this. I don't think there's one answer. You know, everyone's different. Obviously, if rabbi's a joke, you know, like that, like in a certain negative way, we're not talking about that, you know? Certain people need that, you know... Certain people need that slap. Certain people need that harsh love. Certain people need the love and the relationship. Certain people need a little bit of both. I really don't think there's one answer because I know from my own experiences. Certain times in life, certain things work for me. Certain times I didn't. And even now, certain rabbanim I connect to, and certain I don't. If I recommend, I can't say, oh, you know, I meaning. If I know you in a personal, Berg knows you so well, if you say, oh, I think you need this, he'd give a recommendation. But it's really about, you know, where you want to go, and is that rabbi taking you there? The problem is a lot of times, is that you don't really know where you want to go, and maybe you need the rabbi saying it to you. You know, there's, I'm keeping things in general. I really don't think there's one answer to that. But I'll say that... Is that, you know, more often than not, people do need that push. That's definitely you know if I have to do my own cheshbon nefesh, it's, you know, I have to push more and more. That's for sure. But But again, there's no one answer, and if you're doing what you're supposed to do because of a certain rabbi, for example, you know, I'll be honest here, you know, I'm saying, you know, if you have Reb Lachman and Reb Tarrigan, so they're much older than us, you know, much more knowledgeable than us, but I think you all made the right choice, you know, coming here, you know, come out, yeah. The point is, I think this is a perfect example. You have two different rabbis. The Rabbi Berg and I are very different, also, you know. And but the point is that you can have two different groups, two different types of rabbis. You really could gain from all of them.
I'll say one thing. I had a coach in high school that I hated. I hated him. He was so mean, like really legitimately mean. And one time in gym, I'm going to do the Allen Iverson. We're not talking about practice. Not practice. We're talking about gym. So he had a rule that you never, ever finger-rolled the ball in. You always went glass. So in gym, I stole the ball, fast break. I tried to finger-roll it in, and I went off back iron. The man was like 83 years old, and he had a walker, okay? And he blew his whistle, and he starts with his walker. He gets up, you know, like he's like shaking. He gets up, and he starts to like come towards me. And he's shaking his finger like Parkinson's finger. He's like shaking at me, and he goes, "Borg, that's why you suck." And I remember looking at him going like, and like, what is wrong with you? You know, like, and I promise you that I made the worst mistake. I looked at him and I answered back. I'm like, it's a gym. And that was such a mistake, because now I got like a whole Musar Shmooze. And he's like, it's not gym. It's you play the game right every time, whether it's a gym, a practice, or you're actually in the game. And he's sitting there chewing me out for like a good 5 minutes. And at that point, I'm smart enough to just keep my mouth shut. I'm going like, you're right, coach. You're right, coach. You're right, coach. I'll tell you one thing. I never finger-rolled it again. I was ticked at him at the time. I thought like, what did you need to do that for? But I never did it again. There's value to having a tough Rebbe in your life. And it doesn't mean that you shouldn't feel that the Rebbe cares about you. If you feel that Rebbe's abusive, that's not a Mila. If a Rebbe just yells at you and screams at you and demeans you, that's a bad Rebbe. But if a Rebbe who loves you sits you down and tells you a tough truth, that's a good Rebbe. You know what I'm saying? You might not appreciate it in the moment, but you will eventually appreciate it. Chevra, because we're Kemat out of time, this is going to have to be the last question. All right, David, it's on you. You didn't ask yet, right? No, in the back. Hey, go loud. How do you hold on from Kolo? That's a great question to end with. Okay, Bromfeld, you want to end?
Come back next year. Yeah? How do you keep it? It's not. I mean, I mentioned this before. You know, about possibly writing a letter. How do you keep it? You know, listen. I'm going to revert to this. All life's not easy. You know, life's not as well as you do now. You're definitely. You know, you'll have. We all have our ups and downs. That's for sure. We all have that. That's life, and that's normal. I think our bird went even far saying, if you don't have downs, something's wrong. So you will have your downs. I would say, again, there are tricks. I got a good idea. Write a letter, you know, have a Rebbe, all those stuff. But I'm confident enough to say, if you do what you're supposed to do, you know, if you're doing what you're supposed to be doing here, and you put yourself, you know, you got to put yourself, when you go back to America, in an environment to succeed. That's all you have to do. That's all you can do. That's all coaches say. You know, everyone says, you know, how much could a coach do? He puts his team, you know, in a situation where he could succeed. And that's, again, the greatest athletes that they lose, you know, that it hurts. But they could go to bed at night saying, you know, we put ourselves in that situation. Unfortunately, you know, it didn't work out, you know. So it's putting yourself in the right situation. You know, going back to America and, you know, going to parties. How did I break so many gear? Like, yeah, well, that's what happens when you go to that party. You know what I'm saying? You know, like, what do you think is going to happen? You know, how did I miss Minion? Yeah, if you're watching that TV show, wherever you're watching at night in bed at 4 a.m., of course, you know, you're going to do that. So it's putting yourself, doing what you have to do now, okay? But it's really putting yourself in that environment to succeed, you know? And if you do that and you have your downs, don't worry, because that's life. If you don't do that, then that's when you have a big problem. But you'll do that. You know, you came to the right, this is the best camp. You know, you came to the right place. And do what you have to do here. Put yourself in the right place, and you'll be fine.
I'll finish with this, because I think it's a great question.
I asked that same question to Rav Parnas. My Rebbe's 89 years old. I asked him that same question. I was having a good streak. It was a couple years ago. I was having a really good streak where I was really passionate about my Judaism. And I said to him, Rebbe, how do I hold on to this? And he said to me, you don't. You hold on to the memory of it. And he's 89 years old. This is a couple years ago, so we'll say he was 86 years old. He told me that he remembers a summer from when he was 15 years old. His Rebbe had fundraised money for him to go to a camp. Back then, it wasn't so simple that every Jew went to camp. His Rebbe fundraised money so that he could go to a camp. And that was a summer where he really turned it around religiously. He wasn't like one of these like Fafrumta kids who was always doing everything right. He ended up being one of the Gedolim and Lumdus of his generation. But at the time, he was just a 15-year-old kid. And it was this unbelievable month. And of course, when he came, when he was finished, he crashed back down. But the memory of that month was so strong that it stayed with him even now when he's in his 80s. And the memory of NCSY Kollel, it could really stay with you forever. It could be a real touchstone in your life where you say, I made choices in my life because of that summer that brought me here today. I always tell everyone on NCSY Kollel, I never would have come to NCSY Kollel when I was 16 years old. I didn't know NCSY Kollel existed, and nobody was stupid enough to try to pitch me to come to NCSY Kollel because they would have gotten laughed out of the room. NCSY Sports tried, and that was a real embarrassment. You guys are unbelievable. You're unbelievable. You give up your summer to come. Yeah, we have an awesome time playing ball and going on Tulum and bungee jumping and going to the blind museum and the deaf museum and whatever old museum they have these days. I'm saying like every disability has a museum now. But like the you're going to have an awesome summer. But you chose to spend your time in a camp where you're learning morning Seder and night Seder. That means you're already doing pretty awesome. But the memory of what you've done this summer, the relationships that you've built, the way that you feel, that could take you with you, even when you're not doing so great. Rav Gosai, thank you so much for tonight. Please, let's go to Rabbi Tversky.